It's here and now. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon have accepted separate invitations to come to the United States to continue peace talks. This follows 2 days of meetings in Jerusalem with U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. There's no word yet on whether President Bush will attend those talks. Today, Rice also named a U.S. official to help coordinate Palestinian security, and that appointee will visit the Middle East within the next 2 weeks. And the U.S. has promised more than $40 million in aid to the Palestinians in the coming months. Joining us now, Michael Matza. He's in Jerusalem covering this story for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Michael, this is breaking news, but how much can you tell us first about this invitation from President Bush to these two leaders? Obviously, this is a shift in policy after the death of Yasser Arafat.
Yes, Prime Minister Sharon, as you know, has been to the United States and been to see President Bush a lot of times, mm-hmm. but President Arafat was basically boycotted by the U.S. administration towards the end of his life. And President Bush had been saying that the Palestinians needed new leadership. He said that as far back as June 24th, 2002, when he laid out his vision for two states living side by side in peace and security, and he said that the Palestinians really needed to reform. They have had recent elections in which they chose a new leadership, Mahmoud Abbas, known as Abu Mazen, and this invitation to him, I think, does represent a real departure in U.S. policy.
The other story today is that the U.S. is appointing a new security coordinator for the Palestinian territories, Lieutenant General William Ward. He has served in top army positions and on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. A less formal involvement than the U.S. might have.
We've had General Anthony Zinni was here famously for a while during a very bloody period here and basically ended his mission here without very much success. I was talking to a Palestinian analyst today who I was asking him just about this, what he thought the significance of the appointment of a U.S. security coordinator was, and his first comment was, well, it failed before. The thinking is that perhaps this time the coordination would be more on an intelligence level so that you don't have a coordinator refereeing infractions of a ceasefire which may emerge, but rather a lot of intelligence coordination to try and prevent incidents that could sort of sabotage the quiet that everybody's trying to achieve here.
Mm. And what about the aid package that Secretary Rice announced today, $40 million in aid to the Palestinians to be doled out over the next 3 months?
This $40 million, as I understand it, is part of the $350 million that President Bush announced in his State of the Union address, and it represents the United States putting its money where its mouth is. The United States asked for changes in the Palestinian leadership and a new approach, and they've got a leader now in Abu Mazen who supports negotiations instead of violence to try and achieve goals, and they're coming up with the money to show that they really mean it when they support it.
And, Michael, we understand you're on your way now to Sharm el-Sheikh for the Palestinian-Israeli summit meeting tomorrow. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, King Abdullah of Jordan, will also attend. What's expected to happen there?
From the people that I'm talking to, there's a lot of thinking that this will be a public display that the parties are back on the track of negotiations, that there won't necessarily be any earth-shattering announcements out of the summit itself, because a lot of the issues have been worked on sort of by working groups in the past 2 weeks. The questions of prisoner release, the questions of opening the crossings into Gaza. These things have been sort of worked on and announced in the past 2 weeks in dribs and drabs. The summit is more likely to simply confirm these things in a kind of very public way and try and demonstrate to both Palestinians and Israelis that they're back on the track to talking.
Well, Michael, very serious mission and very serious purpose, but I need to ask you one quick question. You being from Philadelphia and you traveling with Condoleezza Rice, perhaps the biggest football fan in Washington, when President Bush announced her appointment, he said he wished that he could give her the job she really wanted, which was the head of the NFL. Has she commented at all on the results of last night's game?
No, not that I know of. I certainly didn't ask her anything about it, and I haven't heard that she's commented.
And our sympathies to you.
Well, thanks. The Eagles fans, I think, are suffering tonight, but it was a good show.
Michael Matza covers the Middle East for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He was speaking to us from Jerusalem. Michael, thank you.
Robin, thanks a lot.
And we have this note just in from the Associated Press. Israeli and Palestinian officials now say they will declare a ceasefire at tomorrow's summit. And now a moment for sports. Yes, the New England Patriots did beat the Philadelphia Eagles last night to win their third Super Bowl in 4 years, and it's official. The Pats are a football dynasty, and Coach Bill Belichick assumes the title of winningest postseason coach in NFL history, ahead of legendary Green Bay Packers coach Vince Lombardi. An amazing transformation for a coach who was disliked by players on previous teams. They thought he was aloof. Well, what is it like to play for Bill Belichick? Quarterback Tom Brady was asleep, so we're turning to 12-year-old Luke Schultz. He's a member of the Weston Wildcats lacrosse team in Weston, Massachusetts. Yes, in addition to his NFL duties, Belichick coaches his son Brian's lacrosse team. Luke, you've played for him in the league. What's it like?
He was surprisingly shy, and he didn't really like to be known as the coach of the New England Patriots.
You're kidding.
No. So He was kind of shy about that.
Yeah. What are some of the things you remember Coach Belichick teaching you when you were playing lacrosse for him?
He would, focus on a lot of stick handling, and he knew a lot of the fundamentals, but he wouldn't jump at you saying, oh, that's wrong. He would more hint at you and help you with your style and skills.
So what were your thoughts, in addition to being concerned when you thought he looked worried last night, what were your thoughts when you were watching the Super Bowl?
I hope to God that we win.
And when the Patriots did?
I just saw him rejoicing, and the look on his face was exactly how it is at the end of a good lacrosse game.
You're serious?
Yeah.
The same as for 11-year-old kids as it is for, you know, the Patriots?
He just gets so into the sports that to him it's the same whether he's coaching full-grown men or 12-year-olds.
Luke, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Luke Schultz plays lacrosse in Weston, Massachusetts, where Patriots coach Bill Belichick, known as Brian's dad, helps coach youth lacrosse. The Bush administration released a $2.5 trillion federal budget today, calling for cuts largely in domestic programs. There were some cuts in military spending, but overall the Pentagon was the biggest winner, with an increase in spending of $20 billion. Vice President Dick Cheney, speaking on Fox News Sunday, said this budget is the tightest the administration has ever submitted.
It's not something we've done with the Meat Acts, nor are we suddenly turning our back on the most needy people in our society.
Well, joining us now from Washington is the budget guru of the Los Angeles Times, reporter Joel Haveman. And Joel, $2.5 trillion, is this the tightest budget this administration has submitted?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. It's the biggest budget, but it's also the tightest. It cuts more programs than any previous budget. But it remains to be seen whether Congress will accept those cuts.
Right. 150 programs, as we are told. And by the way, when you say biggest budget, in many ways it seems the heftiest. 500 pages?
Well, that's just the budget document itself. If you count the supplementary materials, the explanatory stuff, it's about 2,400.
Okay. Well, reporters who had seen some of the budget prior to today's full release said that the cuts included everything from migrant workers to local police departments. What's your sense, if you could tick off some of the programs that are going to be cut?
Well, Medicaid probably takes the biggest cut of all. Mm-hmm. Food stamps takes a hit. Agricultural subsidies, jobs programs. It's hard to know where to stop.
We're going to talk more about Medicaid in a moment, but let's keep going on that list. Apparently, there's no money in the budget for Amtrak. EPA, 5.6% cut. Community block grants and law enforcement grants cut. How do the law enforcement cuts square with the Bush administration's war on terrorism? Aren't police and fire stations considered to be on the front lines?
Well, there isn't total consistency here, but their argument is that these programs have not been effective.
Well, and the New York Times is reporting today, again, before the full budget was released, that veterans are going to have to pay higher copays for prescription drugs under the new budget, and some may have to pay annual fees of $250. Again, it seems like a community that the president would not want to alienate right now.
Well, that seems true in a lot of cases. It's certainly true in veterans. It's true with farmers. It's surprising to see that the administration is cutting farm subsidies, when the farm states in the South and the Midwest elected him.
Another surprise might be the cuts in the education department. A third of the 150 programs being cut are in education.
But many of them are tiny. There are little $1, $2, and $3 million programs that were set up to satisfy a particular interest or a particular congressman. A lot of those are going. Last year, the administration put out a similar hit list of 65 programs about, and I haven't counted them up, but I think about half of them were education. And altogether, two of them were eliminated out of the 30 or so that were education, and three programs were consolidated into one. Otherwise, they were unscathed. So keep in mind that what you hear about the president's budget is not necessarily what reality will prove to be at the end of the year.
Right. So the fact that the budget that is proposed today would cut would call for cutting $450 million in the safe and drug-free school grants, $500 million in education technology state grants, $225 million for the Even Start Literacy Program, $280 million for upward-bound programs for inner-city youth. That might not necessarily happen.
Well, I can tell you that for sure the Even Start program was on the list last year, and it survived and can be looked at to survive again. It's very early to tell exactly how Congress is going to dispose of this budget, but I would guess that a lot of it will turn out to be fiction.
And by the way, we should also mention that the budget that's been proposed does not even include several items.
It doesn't include some huge items. For example, the continuing costs of the war in Iraq. There was just an $80 billion supplemental appropriation proposed by the administration for this year. If we get a comparable sum for 2006, which is the budget year, it will be in addition to everything that's in the budget that we got today. Another is Social Security reform. If Congress were to enact Bush's private accounts for Social Security, it would cost something on the order of $750 million, billion in the first 10 years, and there is no sight of that in this budget.
And the third item not included in today's budget, the cost of keeping President Bush's tax cuts permanent.
If they're all done, it'll cost about $50 billion more than the budget acknowledges. And that seems like a likely outcome.
Well, Joel, thank you so much.
Okay.
Happy reading.
Thanks a lot.
Joel Haveman is staff writer for the Los Angeles Times in Washington, D.C. Well, how big are those Medicaid cuts? And what does it mean if mom is heading for a nursing home? If you are, down the road. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our conversation on the White House budget, which was released today. The biggest line items in the budget, the military, Social Security, and health programs such as Medicare and Medicaid. And while a prescription drug benefit is being added for seniors on Medicare, the Bush administration is proposing some drastic cuts in health care for the low income and the disabled. And joining us on the line now is Ken Thorpe, chair of the Health Policy Department at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Ken, nice to talk to you again.
Oh, it's nice to be back. Thank you.
And as we just heard, Medicaid's taking a big cut. We're hearing reports of anywhere from $45 to $60 billion. So how does that translate, you know, at the clinic level? More lines, fewer doctors. What does it mean?
Well, you know, the cuts really fall into three areas. One is they're going to make it more difficult for states to raise money through taxing health care providers and by transferring money through public hospitals to raise federal dollars. So in those states that have those approaches to generate money, it could have a very important and potentially big impact on the shape of the Medicaid program in those states.
Mm-hmm. And how else?
Well, they're also proposing to change the way that Medicaid pays for prescription drugs. which is probably a good move because Medicaid has been overpaying for prescription drugs, and there are some savings built into the formula by which Medicaid uses to pay for those drugs.
Right, right. Right now, the states, the more they pay, the more they get back.
Right, and, you know, they have a rebate formula, but it's one of those fun things that it's a rebate off of a hypothetical price. And obviously, as that price goes up, the value of the rebate, even though it's large, really doesn't bear any relationship to the underlying production costs of those drugs.
And Ken, as we're speaking about this, I mean, this just illustrates how confusing it is. There's all sorts of, it's a tangled web, and it's a very burdensome one to states. I'm looking at a report in the Wall Street Journal. Mississippi, for instance, their health program for the poor has doubled to $3.5 billion. A quarter of state residents are on the program, and many people in states are saying, you know, they're already swamped, they're already overwhelmed by Medicaid costs, and now there might be federal cuts.
Yeah, and I think what that is saying is that we probably need to have a more fundamental reexamination of this system, because much of the increase in Medicaid spending is due to the fact that we have more and more people that are eligible for the program, largely because they are low income, and this happens obviously in a recession when people lose their jobs and lose their wages. So if we had a broader system of health insurance in this country, that would take a tremendous amount of burden off the states.
Yeah, and you know, there are a lot of boomers confronted right now with parents who don't have any assets, who are needing home health care or nursing home care. Any sense that the situation might change for them? In other words, the indigent who, you know, might have relatives who are not. Any sense that the system is going to start cutting people who otherwise might have been eligible?
Well, certainly Medicaid is the primary payer for nursing home care, and it provides services to a lot of middle-income seniors. And what the White House proposal would do is make it more difficult to transfer some of the assets that seniors have in order to make them become eligible for nursing home care. So built into the proposal is an assumption that fewer seniors would be eligible for the Medicaid program because it would be more difficult for them to transfer assets and therefore make themselves eligible for Medicaid.
I'm sure a lot of people are going to be eyeing this nervously. But the president at the same time is also proposing cut $340 million from rural community health centers. He's proposing to add them for rural community health centers, which doesn't really jive with cutting Medicaid.
No, it doesn't. And again, I think that, you know, that the health care proposal here really is begging for a broader structural framework to figure out the direction that our health care industry is moving. You know, on the one hand, we're building up bricks and mortars with community health centers. On the other hand, we're likely to make fewer people eligible for services provide perhaps less in terms of long-term care for our seniors. So it really is somewhat of a schizophrenic health care budget proposal.
Right. Now, the President and the Congress, as we know, approved a $500 billion new drug benefit for seniors on Medicare. And now the Congressional Budget Office is saying the cost of Medicare will rise $55 billion this year alone. So, I mean, is your sense that politically health care really is the third rail of American politics as opposed to Social Security reform?
Well, if you think about it, Medicare is facing the same set of demographic challenges that Social Security is facing, except that the per-person growth in expenditures is rising at about three times the rate. So it's a much more substantial long-term federal budget issue compared to Social Security. So, you know, one would think that it's a bigger problem, that it might behoove us to spend more time focusing on how we think about health care and restructuring health care as opposed to, you know, Social Security, which really with some very minor changes in the program could be made solvent for, into the 22nd century.
Are there other health policy reforms that might help bring down the bottom line? You know, every $10 million or so counts.
Oh, absolutely. And again, you know, some of it has to deal with going back to the fundamentals on what's driving the increase in health care spending. And one of the things that we talk about sometimes, but not often enough, is the rise in obesity in this country. It affects Medicaid and it affects private health insurance. The rise in the number of people who are seriously overweight is generating about a third of the growth in expenditures over the last 10 or 15 years. And you see it through this explosion in the number of people who have diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol levels, back problems, arthritis, and so on. And, you know, that's an area that, you know, we have not spent nearly enough time focusing on, but it's one of the major cost drivers in our country.
Yeah, we're not spending the time, but perhaps spending the money.
Yeah, doing neither.
Ken Thorpe, chair of the Health Policy Department at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Ken, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
I stand before you today as a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the presidency of the United States of America.
The year was 1972. Shirley Chisholm, the first black female congresswoman, also became the first woman of color to make a serious run for the presidency. And as she campaigned, she would also have to defend her right to run in response to critics from every angle of the political spectrum, right up to the Democratic National Convention, when George McGovern was nominated to run against Richard Nixon. Shirley Chisholm died earlier this year, but her 1972 grassroots campaign comes alive in a new documentary, Chisholm 72. Unbought and Unbossed. And joining us on the line, filmmaker Shala Lynch. Welcome, Shala.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
And we're also joined by feminist author Susan Brownmiller, who appears in the film. Susan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And Shala, I want to start with you. Walter Cronkite referred to Shirley Chisholm's declaration, of her run as throwing her bonnet into the ring. It didn't seem to be taken seriously at first. You could not have been born when this was happening, but you certainly know through your work. How serious was Chisholm?
Shirley Chisholm was really pretty serious, and she had several goals. One was a symbolic one, you know, to put a different face on the idea of presidential politics and power. But what I discovered through the making of this film is she actually had a very viable political strategy for getting her issues, progressive issues, to be represented by the eventual nominee. And that was by collecting delegate votes in the primaries. Because in 1972, unlike today, at the convention, the nominee was actually decided. And it was going to be a close enough race that she was gambling that her delegates might make the difference between one nominee or another.
And Susan Brownmiller, set the scene further for us. This was just about the time that the women's movement was beginning to, you know, really reach momentum, and not that long after the civil rights movement. So how extraordinary was Chisholm's run?
Well, it was a great boost to us in the women's movement, I'll tell you that. It was a delight to see her just plunge ahead and say, I am running for president of the United States.
It was extraordinary. I mean, I do remember seeing her and being so compelled by her, not just a woman, not just a black woman, but such an exciting woman.
Well, she certainly was an original in many. Is that Shala laughing?
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Well, now, Shala, and this is someone you've been discovering, you know, as you you know, go through this footage to make your documentary. What, tell us why. Why so extraordinary to you?
Well, you know, I mean, when you're a kid and when I was in high school and college, I had an idea of who she was, the first black woman elected to Congress, but it didn't mean very much to me emotionally. I understood it as just an intellectual fact, right? What happens when you get out in the working world and you understand how race and gender works and is affecting your life, then to rediscover her and the work that she did as a congresswoman, and then to rediscover that she ran for president and that we've kind of forgotten about this,
yeah, history.
And that she was still alive to help tell the story, I became obsessed.
Well, Susan Brown-Miller, you mentioned how exciting it was for the burgeoning women's movement to have this woman out on the campaign trail, but she had a comment about how she was viewed by some white women in the women's movement and the Congressional Black Caucus at the time. Let's first hear Shirley Chisholm.
The women didn't want me to discuss what the black people were talking about. The black people didn't want any of the women's programs. So it was that kind, and I was trying to bring everybody together. It was a hell of a position to be in.
Susan Brown-Miller, your thoughts?
Well, I do remember that some women who were wedded to the Democratic Party and thought they were real operatives, I'll have to say the names, you know, Bella Abzug is one, they went into that convention thinking that the best hope for the Democrats was George McGovern.
Didn't some people feel that she shouldn't be running because she might be a spoiler?
Yes, but she wasn't a spoiler at all. One of the most poignant moments in Shala's film is when Ron Dellums, the black congressman from California, releases his delegates and says that he is going to support McGovern at the last minute. You know, Shala, I had forgotten that until I saw it in your film.
Ron Dellums, who was in the Congressional Black Caucus,
yes,
along with other names that we recognize, John Conyers and others. But you're saying what, that he
was a supporter of Chisholm's all the way up until the convention, and then there was tremendous pressure from him within the Democratic Party to support McGovern.
And just briefly, Susan, when she mentioned that the women didn't want to hear the black people's issues, there was some competition early on between two movements, each trying to, you know, have a public voice.
Many women felt that the new women's movement was taking momentum away from the civil rights movement. They were still, and rightly, working for civil rights. And now we have this new women's movement putting forward new issues, new priorities, a new agenda. So it put a lot of black women in a bind. It didn't put Shirley Chisholm in a bind because she understood the two oppressions.
Yeah. Well,
she absolutely did. And, you know, she didn't want to be just her race or just her gender. She wanted to be an individual American. Who embodied both.
And such a dynamic American. One of the things we're reminded of in your film, Shala, is how she spoke. Let's listen to a part of a campaign speech.
That people are sick and tired of the Tweedledee-Dees and the Tweedledee-Dums who constantly flip-flap from one side to another. People are interested in having candidates that are truthful. Candidates that have, if you will, just a tiny bit of morality and a tiny bit of integrity. And people that they believe they can go to sleep at night and know that they're not selling them out or selling out the communities in which they live.
Susan Brown-Miller and Shala, I'm feeling as if I would love to hear that voice, that passion. It feels so unfiltered now.
Yes. And you know what Shirley Chisholm would say is, listen, I put in my time and I worked as hard as I could. And I think that she really thought of herself as kind of an ordinary woman. And the way I think of her is an ordinary woman who tapped into the extraordinary in herself. And that we all have that in us. She wanted other people to participate. It wasn't just about her. She really wanted to draw more people to the process. So she would say, if there's not a Shirley Chisholm out there now, it's our fault. Who's stepping up to the plate?
Yeah. And Susan, do you think, you know, some people thought that she was just a symbol, you know, just a curiosity. What is her legacy?
Well, she'll never lose her place in history. And thank goodness we have Shala's film now as a reminder, because it is unfortunately true that blacks and women tend to get written out of history as time goes by.
And Shala, as a young black woman, how has Shirley Chisholm impacted you?
She's impacted me in a profound way because it's renewed my interest in fighting the good fight. She's renewed my faith in a life of service and progress towards a better democracy.
That's filmmaker Shala Lynch. Chisholm 72, Unbought and Unbossed, is the film she's made about Shirley Chisholm. It's scheduled to air tonight on PBS stations around the country. By the way, for more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Shala, thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
And author Susan Brown Miller, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
Still to come, young people react to a film which tells them what happens when kids their age end up in adult prisons. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, the U.S. economy is recovering, but if you're a worker, you may not feel it yet. Many economists say job growth numbers are still anemic. Almost 200,000 new jobs were created last month, but the figure fell far below expectations. And for some perspective, we turn now to Here and Now business reporter Mark Mills. Mark, explain this for us. The economy in its fourth year of economic recovery, but where are those jobs?
It's been very slow this time, Robin, and we're in a different economy than the last time we were coming out of a recession back in 1991. And this time we're in a globalized economy. Companies are having a hard time raising prices without losing customers, so they've been very focused on cost cutting to remain competitive. That means they're investing in technology and new equipment to save labor instead of hiring workers. And this higher productivity in the workplace allows companies to actually crank out more products with fewer workers.
Mm-hmm.
We have a much more flexible workforce now as well. Companies want to use more part-timers and temporary workers, giving them a lot of freedom and flexibility to expand or shrink the labor force quickly and easily. And that is maybe holding back the creation of good new full-time jobs. And the high cost of benefits, such as health care, discourages the creation of full-time jobs.
Also, we're seeing, as we see here in Boston, companies using their cash to buy other companies.
A lot of companies do have mountains of cash. They're awash in cash, but they're not using it to create jobs. They might be involved in mergers, acquisitions, or maybe buying back some of their stock.
And you mentioned that we were in a different kind of economy. How does this slow job growth compare to past economic recoveries?
Well, a study's been done on this by the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. And of the 10 recessions from the end of World War II to 1991, it took an average of about 21 months for the economy to regain all the jobs that were lost during the recession. This time, it has taken more than twice that long to accomplish that.
Wow. Wow. And how many jobs would it take to keep pace?
Well, you need about 150,000 new jobs a month just to keep pace with the growth of the population and the workforce.
Right. That's the number of people who are just naturally coming into the workforce.
Yeah. So you're not even going to see great growth in employment with 150,000. And we only had 146,000 jobs added in January and just 133,000 in December. So it's pretty anemic.
And this would have an obvious impact on workers. I mean, it's tough to find a job.
It is. People are, if they're out of work for some reason, they have a harder time finding a good and comparable job. Many people have given up looking for jobs. In Friday's report, in fact, the unemployment rate actually dropped to 5.2% from 5.4%. But that wasn't because of great job growth. It was because a lot of people have been discouraged and given up looking, so they're not in the force that's counted as looking for work, and they're not counted as unemployed.
Right, they're not registering. Well, what is the effect of this on salaries?
Well, you've got the law of supply and demand. When there's a lot of something, the price of it will not likely go up. And when there's a lot of labor, then the price of labor or wages stays pretty flat. Companies are not in competition for workers, so they don't have to offer more money to keep workers or hire new ones. And in fact, wage growth was very slow last year. The average weekly wages rose 2.3% in 2004. That was below the inflation rate of 3.3%.
So, Mark Mills, what do you think? Is this going to become a way of life?
Some economists, Robin, say, yes, welcome to the new world of employment, that with global competition and new labor-saving technology, job growth is just going to be soft going forward. Don't compare it to the past. Others question whether the government is actually measuring job growth accurately. Some economists say that many other measures of economic health right now are much more positive, and they think the jobs numbers, for some reason, aren't reflecting that, so they may be wrong. It could just be that the economy is in a period of change and flux, and that workers and employers are kind of improvising in this changing world, that there's so much freelance and temporary work going on and entrepreneurial work that government statisticians are just behind the curve of what's actually happening in the trenches.
Yeah, we should say that many conservative economists say that there's actually been more employment growth under Bush, President Bush, than he's given credit for. And they cite regular surveys of the workers themselves.
It's true that the Labor Department surveys establishments, have you created a job in the last month? And they survey households, are you working? And the household survey shows more people are working than the establishment survey would indicate, and that's a sign that something may be wrong in the way they're gathering the data.
Right. Well, Mark, I'm sure you will find out what that is. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Here Now's business reporter Mark Mills. Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now. Young, it's Here and Now with this summary of the news today in Iraq. It was a deadly day. At least 30 people were killed by insurgents in the cities of Baquba and Mosul. In Baquba, a car bomb exploded outside the gates of a provincial police headquarters. Many of the victims were looking for jobs. And in Mosul, a suicide bomber blew himself up inside the compound of a teaching hospital, killing a dozen policemen guarding the site. The attacks are the latest sign that insurgents are targeting Iraq's security forces, which the U.S. hopes will assume a greater role once the newly elected government takes office. U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld says attacks like today's, coupled with other uncertainties in Iraq, make it impossible to determine when Iraqi forces will assume control of security. Rumsfeld, speaking on ABC's This Week, said the security situation in Iraq also depends on Iraq's neighbors.
We don't know what the behavior of Iran and Syria is going to be. We don't know the extent to which they're going to be unhelpful or helpful.
Today's attacks come on the heels of a new wave of kidnappings. Yesterday, four Egyptian technicians were seized in western Baghdad, and on Friday, an Italian journalist was kidnapped. Meantime, Iraqis are waiting for a final tally from last week's election. Initial reports point to a landslide win by Shiite Muslim candidates who were endorsed by their clerics. A final tally is expected Thursday. In courts across the country and for the past decade, more young people are being tried as adults. Some of the young offenders are caught up in the adult system, and they are the filmmakers and subjects of a new documentary called Juvies, directed by Leslie Neal. The film was shown in the Boston area as part of the Human Rights Watch International Film Festival. It's also getting a viewing in some area public schools. Here Now's Athena Desai has this report.
Puffy black parkas and slim backpacks seem almost the uniform for teenagers at English High School in Jamaica Plain. These freshmen are shuffling into the auditorium to watch a documentary on juvenile justice. But first, 22-year-old Daniel Cacho grabs a microphone.
Soaked in guilt, in this haunted house of filth I built. Caught into nightmares of my blood being spilled because my cap got pilled. Trapped in doom, and I never once been told to go to my room. I got poison in my roots that I didn't sow, but I know only by watering them will my good seeds grow.
Daniel is one of the ex-offenders who's presenting the film called Juvies, which takes a naked look at the fates of a dozen young people at the largest juvenile facility in the country.
All the kids you see here in Orange, they're being prosecuted as adults. Today, over 200,000 kids are sent through the adult court system each year. To find out who these kids are, a group of filmmakers went to East Lake Central Juvenile Hall in Los Angeles.
Boston native Mark Wahlberg narrates this film. He himself bounced in and out of both the juvenile and adult systems in Massachusetts. He tells the story of these 12 youths charged with crimes ranging from assault and robbery to murder. All 12 stories are unbelievably tragic. Kids who were beaten, raped, and abused, and became court-involved very young. One that stands out as an example of the severity of the system belongs to a Vietnamese youth named Michael Duc Tha, who calls himself Duck. At 16, he was driving a car with known gang members inside. He says he wasn't expecting it, but someone pulled out a gun and fired onto the street. No one was hurt, and Duck had no prior record, but he was found guilty of attempted murder and sentenced to 35 years to life. He has already served about 6 years in an adult prison.
I came in like around 1 in the morning. It was pitch black, and you hear everybody screaming and rattling the cages. It's pretty chaotic. I'm standing there with my sheet and my blanket in my arms, and I'm just being told to wait. You're stripped down, basically, to your bare skin. And yeah, it's hard at first to get naked in front of grown men, you know, to be searched, you know. But it's all part of the process.
As a result of the publicity around this film, Duck's sentence was reduced to 11 years to life. But advocates and ex-offenders will remind viewers that he was one of the lucky ones.
If you got a question or anything you wanted to say about the film, just raise your hand. And one of us will come to you.
Daniel, who's answering questions about the film, reclaims the mic along with a young Latina woman named Cassandra Gonzalez. The English High kids are reluctant to raise their hands. Daniel and Cassandra try to grease the wheels by sharing their experiences in that same L.A. detention center, the charges against them, and how they'd be locked up right now if they'd been tried as adults. Cassandra says she heard some giggling break through long silences. It's cool to laugh, she says.
But just make sure that you guys are so on lock and got your stuff so together that this will never happen to you. Make sure you know who your friends are, because those same friends that you think are your road dogs, when you get busted, they're not going to be there.
Excuse me,
Daniel steps back in.
Just by showing your hands, how many people in here think that that film has nothing to do with them? Like, why are we even in this room watching that?
Only one person raises his hand. Eventually, students and teachers ask questions about how Daniel and Cassandra find outlets for their anger, whether or not it's actually cool to wear the badge of honor of having served time, and whether their friends were as fortunate to survive.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to meet you.
Daniel, how are you?
18-year-old Karen Truncoso approaches Daniel and Cassandra. She's a member of the civil rights team that sponsored the showing. The film hit close to home.
I still think that I'm vulnerable to, like, fall in a situation like that, because you never know. But I'm really scared for my brother, because my brother has been in jail several times, has been taken by DSS.
Truncoso says ambition is what keeps her from straying off the straight and narrow.
I want to be something. There's no one in my family who's ever done anything. I want to buy a house for my mom one day and, yeah, go to college.
One of Truncoso's mentors is former public defender Anne Wachtmeister. She's been working at English for the past 6 years and says she's never seen an audience there be so attentive. She says kids relate to the film's honesty, and educating them now is more important than ever, given the strong movement to try kids as adults.
And that it's getting easier and easier to do. We're seeing more and more kids that have been sentenced as adults that are still incarcerated today and then are being released to their communities with very little skills.
As tiny clumps of freshmen clear the auditorium, Daniel and Cassandra reflect on the students' feedback. Most who approached had troubles of their own and sought advice on how to make it without getting caught in the system.
I let them know that this is not about being perfect. It's not about, it's about one day at a time, breathing in and out. That's what I do, you know.
Daniel, Cassandra, and one of the film's producers will continue to tour the country with the film. They're still trying to gain access to public schools in Texas, Florida, Georgia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. These states have some of the highest rates of juvenile incarceration in the country.
Our story was produced by Athena Desai. To look at photos and clips from the documentary depicting life for juveniles behind bars, visit our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Manigan, April Peavy, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Ken George. Our newscast producer is Matt Largie. And our interns are Danielle Dreilinger and Kate Goldring. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now. We'll be right back.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.